what if there's a systemic event? Like, what if we have an alopecia again, or something that's, you know, it's truly catastrophic in the sense of like affecting a lot of companies at once. Are you going to get the best attention with a cyber sublimated endorsement on a property policy? I'm not convinced of that. You know, thinking about systemic events, it's not necessarily that like your individual exposure as a corporation will go it might not be a severity issue, but just given the frequency of the events that's happening at the same time to multiple corporations, like, you want to put yourself in the best position to get attention. You know, you don't want to stand in line, but behind all the Fortune 50, 100 companies who are, you know, equipped to deal with this, and then wait, you know, because you don't have the right policy in place, you don't necessarily get that kind of response.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Insurance Leaders Podcast.
Hello, Kelly, and welcome to the show. It's great having you, and I'm really excited to have a chat about cyber insurance. Why don't you open up? Just tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much for having me on. This is really fun. I live in Chicago with my husband. I am the global executive underwriting officer of cyber at Markel. So I sit in the corporate office. We have a bunch of different divisions that sell cyber insurance and reinsurance. And so the corporate level, you know, I have an underwriting strategy role as well as an enterprise risk management role. So I get to work with our CISO's team, our C-suite, and our underwriters. It's a great role.
Cool. All right. So I guess you've talked a bit about yourself, Chicago. It's okay. I'm much more accepting of people from Chicago after all these years. A little bit of tension between Wisconsin.
I'm from New York. I don't know if that makes that worse.
It's much better. It's much better. So all the Chicagoans who watch this are probably going to be really angry with me. But if they know I'm from Wisconsin, they'll understand, because they'll probably make comments about the Wisconsinites. But it's sort of weird because I've been in Arizona and I grew up in Wisconsin. So living in Arizona for a long time, it's Tucson versus Phoenix.
Yeah.
Or I went to University of Arizona and there's Arizona State. So like the worst thing you can say is, oh, you went to Arizona State, right? Or, oh, are you from Phoenix? It's similar. It's not that dissimilar to Wisconsin versus Illinois, I would say. That rivalry.
The first time I ever went to Arizona was Tucson. So I think of a Tucson person. Yeah.
It's better. Tucson's better. I've had this conversation with many people. Tucson's much better than Phoenix. And I do apologize for anybody from Phoenix, but Phoenix is kind of this big wasteland and I don't like it. But I mean, if you're near the mountains, like there's areas of Phoenix that I like, but I just think that all the things I like about Tucson do not exist in Phoenix. Like the mountains are not as close. The desert's kind of further away because it's just all pavement and freeways and, you know, less of the kind of history. But anyways, I digress.
I spent a third of my life in New York, New Jersey, a third in Boston, and a third in Chicago. So from a baseball perspective, it's very confusing.
And all over the place. So why were you in Boston for so long?
Just college, undergrad, my master's, and law school. Yeah. Okay. So I just kept going. And I started around Boston. So it's the best place, I think, in my opinion, in the world to get educated.
Yeah. It's, I guess there's a lot there from an educational standpoint, a lot of good schools. And I guess it's probably fun there because you get a lot of universities, a lot of young people around there.
And Brookline, Massachusetts, I think has the highest, I think the most educated city in the world, Brookline, Mass. Okay. And it's kind of, by virtue of like how many degrees people have. So it's like, it's a very academic city, but it's also very fun.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's a bit similar for me. So I think maybe not exactly third, but I was Wisconsin, then Arizona, then I'll say overseas, a little bit of Spain mixed in with a lot of UK. So it's probably kind of similar. That's why everybody asks, why don't you sound British? Well, I've only been here 10 years. Like, give me another 50 and maybe I'll sound a little different, but I think.
Yeah, or you have to, after a few pints, you might sound British.
I think I sound more Wisconsin. I don't know. I'll start really enunciating vowels or, yeah, using all kinds of Wisconsinite language probably. But yeah, so I guess back to Markel. Did we talk about geographies that you focused on? You said global.
Yeah, so it's a global role. You know, the main geographies that we sell insurance from are the U.S., Bermuda, the U.K., and Germany. And we're starting to do more in other parts of the EU and a little bit in Asia Pac. So those are emerging geographies for us.
Okay. Interesting. So yeah, it is still quite global. Germany's an interesting market. I've been hearing a lot about Germany lately and insurance in Germany. I don't think I know the market too well, but it does feel like it's maybe the next market, at least in terms of Europe.
Yeah, it definitely does seem to be. We've been getting a lot of traction there for sure.
Yeah, it makes sense. So when you look at what Markel's good at, what would you say your strength is in cyber?
You know, we're excellent at a number of different industries. So like we do all kinds of sizes of corporations, and we've just been able to leverage the insurance platform really across the whole globe because we've been acquisitive over time. So, you know, we have underwriters from Bermuda that are just experts in that market. We have two different aspects of our US business that does large enterprise with a lot of retail brokers. And then we also do SME business, but, you know, and middle market. And I'd say that's where the majority of our portfolio is, just by like policy count.
Yeah.
And then we have a big team in London that does a lot of the large enterprise business, but they also manage some of our delegated business for SME. So we really have like a healthy diversity. Yeah. I would say large enterprises, you know, more sweet spot, because, you know, I think the InsurTech model is better at being adept at smaller middle size business, you know, can handle a lot of flow just by virtue of being a smaller size organization. When you get into a complex organization like ours, it's, you know, it could be a little unwieldy. So,
yeah. Okay. I guess jumping into some of the cyber insurance questions, you know, I'll try to behave myself on this one, but you know, when we were talking about this, I know I got a little ranty. One of my pet peeves is sort of the thought of, or the things I see in the press, that cyber insurers don't pay claims. Cyber insurance doesn't pay claims. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's unbelievable. I can't believe that people still have that view. I mean, I think if you're engaged in the insurance world, or even if you're not, I mean, even if you just read headline news, you've seen in the past, you know, 12 to 18 months, the cyber market hardening as far as the rate environment. So rates have gone up tremendously. If you don't know that, you live in a hole. But, you know, and the reason for that, the main reason for that is because so many claims were paid historically. I mean, I guess in the beginning of the cyber journey, you know, loss ratios were very low. You started to see them pick up around 2016, 2017. And then, you know, with the ransomware as a service type of model entering into the space, it just went crazy. And you saw the deterioration of loss ratios because carriers were paying those claims. So I'm not sure where this notion is coming from. The other part of it is that, you know, the coverage, I don't pretend to think that the coverage has been stagnant over, you know, the course of the late 90s to now. It has changed a lot, but especially during that soft part of the market, which I would say between 2000 and maybe even 2016, coverage broadened a lot. I mean, we added on the time element piece with the business interruption, added on rep harm, added on a restoration, first party really came into view. So very very wide open coverage, very expansive coverage in order to try to sell the product and make it more meaningful. So that's another reason why I can't believe, you know, the people think that we don't pay.
I've certainly gotten in battles, you know, with folks over it when I saw some of the war exclusion stuff be published, you know, and a lot of, and it wasn't one sort of person, but I just kept seeing all over the place, all over the press, people talking about that being an excuse to not pay claims. But the reality is if insurance companies stop paying cyber claims, it ends as a class of business. Like that's the whole point. You have to pay claims.
Yeah. Otherwise there's no value to the product. Right. I think the unique thing about it is that, you know, when a company's have undergoing an incident, especially if you're a primary carrier, mm-hmm. you're the first phone call is the carrier, you know, because we're providing the incident response.
Yeah.
And we're really handholding the organization, depending on the size of the organization, through that incident. Mm-hmm. And all those costs are, you know, either eroding the retention or being paid out by the insurance company. So I think if people actually have an experience with a cyber incident and they have insurance, I think they begin to understand and break down some of those misnotions or whatever you want to call them about whether, you know, there's payment, because certainly, yeah, we're paying.
Yeah. Well, I think it's funny too, because it can cause, you know, slowness on the part of the insureds to actually respond to an incident, because they'll have this lack of faith that, you know, something's going to be paid, or a lack of understanding of the coverage, and they'll wait. And it's like, no, you need to move on this. No matter what, you need to move on this. Appreciate, you know, there in theory, there could be some reason it doesn't get paid, and you may not know minute one, but, you know, call the insurer, get their help, move through the incident, you know?
Yeah. So, I remember seeing that a lot more like a couple of years ago. You know, we're talking about like, should we put like a more compelling language in the policy? Like you have to report it with an XYZ. But I think because we were getting like late, not late, but just after the incident arose, it had gotten worse before it could get better and we weren't involved. But I think I've seen a change in recent years. Like most people do pick up the phone and call the hotline. And, you know, so there is more respect for the value of the insurance policy, I would say, recently.
So would you say, just kind of broadening a bit, what do you think about non-cyber policies that are covering cyber? Not silent, but more like extensions or, you know, I don't know, like bundle the cyber cover into there. How do you think this kind of impacts maybe the insurance buyer or impacts the market?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of it. So, I mean, it's one of those things where I understand it, and I understand the reasons for why it happened. And some of the reasons were that, you know, it was a selling proposition, like, hey, you can get cyber for this and it's for free. And, you know, historically it wasn't like a big charge to get the extra coverage, and people were kind of quasi worried about it. The other thing is, you know, we have cyber as a peril, and I think to the buyer and the broker and even the underwriters to some extent, like, where does it fit? You know, does it fit completely under cyber as a line of business? Does it fit in these other places? So I understand the product as being a complement to traditional policies that people buy. Mm-hmm. The way it's being done now, I really wish that people would sort of move away from that. Not only from a selling aspect, from a buying aspect. You know, if you are supplementing some coverages in cyber policy, you know, maybe you're only getting the third party and maybe you're not getting any first party. I just wonder how meaningful it is really, you know, from a limits perspective, depending on severity of event, and like what it's really going to help you do to mitigate the incident. So, I mean, the most effective policy you can buy is a standalone cyber policy in general. And so I really want to encourage people to sell and buy that way and to really fully appreciate within their organization. Like, and if you can't afford to buy a standalone cyber policy, that doesn't mean like you're out of it, right? Like you have to do the risk analysis of like how much of that risk you want to retain or transfer. I guess from a risk transfer perspective, I'm not sure that sublimit is really, I'm not convinced that for most customers, that's the best kind of product you can get.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think, you know, especially in just kind of thinking about the claim side of it as well. Like if you don't know what policy you have, what cover you have, how you engage your claims hotline, how you engage your cyber claims, you know, I think that could create issues as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I guess the other part of it, Anthony, is like, what if there's a systemic event? Like, what if we have an Apache again or something that's, you know, it's truly catastrophic in the sense of like affecting a lot of companies at once. Are you going to get the best attention with a cyber sublimited endorsement on a property policy? I'm not convinced of that. You know, thinking about systemic events, it's not necessarily that like your individual exposure as a corporation will go. It might not be a severity issue, but just given the frequency of the events that's happening at the same time to multiple corporations, you want to put yourself in the best position to get attention. You know, you don't want to stand in line, but behind all the Fortune 50, 100 companies who are, you know, equipped to deal with this and then wait, you know, because you don't have the right policy in place, you don't necessarily get that kind of response.
Yeah. And I suppose that sort of connects into a little bit, again, jumping slightly, but the kind of the lack of depth, the, you know, in terms of, you know, enough underwriters, enough claims people, you know, I think that's kind of an interesting topic as well. You know, how can we deal with sort of that either from a company perspective or, you know, adding individuals, adding other companies that are maybe more focused on certain kinds of claims or, you know, TPAs or MGAs or whatever. Think that it brings that sort of issue. I don't quite know how to how to transition into that, but it is kind of related, right? Like you have a lot of cyber demand. Some of it's not really well seen because it's in these little extension policies that maybe over a long period of time people forgot they had, so they're not calling, and then you have a big event, and then they need help. And I think it is related.
Yeah. And I mean, I think we could link it to like another big kind of picture thing with inflation and, you know, seeing, you know, the cost of some of these services to remediate going up. And maybe there's, like you said, scarcity as far as, you know, the appropriate amount of underwriters, claims people, response teams to deal with this. I mean, we've saw an explosion of hiring, you know, in certain tech sectors, which was great. Now we've seen some cuts because of the economy and economic conditions, but insurance, you know, I worry about it because, you know, everyone's right now looking for cyber underwriters, cyber claims people. It's really hard to attract people to the site, you know, to the insurance industry in general.
Yeah.
Not the hottest industry.
That's only for people that don't know it. That's one of the funniest things about living in this country is there's like generations of insurance people. Because everybody kind of knows about it, but it is much more fun than people think it is once you get here. But you never see people in insurance in school almost.
Totally. Like we're selling it wrong, right? Like,
yeah.
But I mean, that said, like we've been seeing more and more risk management programs pop up, insurance programs pop up in the States. So like you can at least get a degree in it. I always joke with my husband in law school. He's in insurance as well. He signed up for 3 insurance law classes. They were all canceled because no one would go. Yeah. You know, this is our livelihoods and it's a lot of people's livelihoods who went to school. So yeah, we're not really good at selling the profession.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely contributes to some of the risk is the risk of not enough talent coming in, but there's also the risk, you know, in terms of like filling the pipeline of the risk we know exists today, or the demand that we know exists today, but also the risk that a big surge event's going to come in and there's not going to be enough people that understand, you know, who could jump in and help on it, or you know, people aren't necessarily taking these courses in university and whatever. And it's just, there's kind of, it's a talent gap in terms of having enough people that have the knowledge necessary.
I mean, like you could have like a single, you know, point of failure type of incident, and maybe you can fix the issue, and then that has collateral uplift for everybody. Yeah. But at the same time, you still need remediation. You still need to get back online. So it's not like the incident's not over for you as a corporation. So.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I guess just, you know, what are the kinds of risks are you seeing out there that that coverage should really be changing to adapt to?
Yeah, I mean, the one that comes to mind right now is the fact that a lot of carriers are blanketly covering regulatory fines and penalties, or at least are not being very clear about it. And there's a danger in that. So, I mean, I grew up in D&O, and, you know, it would be very rare to find a policy that would provide fines and penalties coverage for corporate entity. You know, it starts to be a little bit of a different analysis once an individual is involved with a Wells notice and SEC investigation, and there's fines and penalties assessed. But against a corporational, that was considered an operational risk that the entity was taking on. And you could see why. I mean, it could be a huge number. I think during the pandemic, or the heart of the pandemic, because I guess we're still in it. You know, we could see, you know, the regulators were a little bit, I wouldn't say lax, but we're now entering an environment it's much more active, and it's expected to be much more active, and people making, you know, sort of examples of certain companies, by assessing these fines and penalties. And I'm not saying they're deserving of it or not. I'm just saying the risk transfer aspect for insurance carriers, it's really difficult to manage. I mean, if you're looking at cyber as primarily a short tail line, you know, something that you know about within a matter of days or weeks from an incident, and then you're able to resolve it in a pretty short amount of time, and then you have some companion litigation that you deal with for a couple of years, you know, that's really the tail. But if you're starting to look at regulatory fines and penalties, you know, you could have the regulators coming in 5 to 7 years after the event. So this is really, really extending the tail. And then you're thinking about the cost of capital involved with the cyber product and the predictability of losses, you know, it starts to really get difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting because it had shifted so aggressively to being more like properties, all the issues are on ransomware. It makes sense that maybe we aren't paying enough attention to sort of the fines and penalties, because you get these companies, they're doing something today, you know, who knows what they're doing with data, let's say, and maybe there's some laws passed and there's no way for the underwriter to be ready for that. So it's being underwritten at a certain price, and then wham, you know, X plus number of years later, you know, they start enforcing it aggressively or whatever the case may be. It's just, it's like you said, it's, you know, long tail. And you just weren't expecting that. So it's interesting.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things about cyber. You know, we're at a point where it's maybe 30 years old, and, you know, people are expecting it to sort of level out. And as far as a product goes and like what the offering is, it be standardized. And I just don't think it's there as far as being standardized. I think it's necessarily going to have to reinvent itself every few years just because of the nature of the risk. So does it make it harder to sell? Yeah. Does it make it harder to understand? Yeah. Does it make it harder to quantify? Absolutely. So I think people just need to kind of accept that from the insurance carrier side, as well as the customer, you know, but there's, because of that, you know, it makes it difficult. But regulatory fines and penalties now, if that's sort of like driving a big loss driver on top of ransomware, which I'm not convinced is completely been remediated by either interruption.
We've actually, you know, we've seen it starting to creep back up over the last few weeks, and you know, it's definitely not gone.
Yeah. I mean, if you're just looking at your attritional losses from my perspective, and ransomware and now fines and penalties, going to see another rate hike or, you know, rate increase, or at least stay where it is now. You know, it still begs the question of whether you have enough margin in your book to take on, you know, major systemic loss.
Yeah.
Which is a true possibility.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great point. I think as well, you know, just talking about systemic loss, you know, I quickly mentioned the war exclusion, or the Lloyd's conversation. Because I think that sort of riled a lot of people up that maybe were not necessarily in the industry, and that's how it lets you see a lot of others sort of perception on it. But it does kind of highlight, and it gets you back thinking again. You know, we've talked about systemic risk for years. So, you know, especially around silent cyber, I guess, you know, war exclusion. But I don't know. Do you think, like, even with all that happening, do you think people are paying enough attention to systemic?
Not really. Like, unfortunately, I think a lot of focus shifted because of the ransomware crisis to ransomware, because that was a thing at the moment that was really making cyber unprofitable for some competitors, or potentially unprofitable. So there's a lot of focus on that. And it was great. I mean, it changed the way underwriting was done. I think companies are getting better at mitigation and resilience. So I think it was really good. Silent cyber was an interesting one because, you know, I think it was the realization at the time, which is like 2016, that you could be exposed in every single line of business to a CAD event from cyber. I think that was the realization. And so there was a lot of work being done to make sure that didn't happen. And it's really quiet now, right? You don't hear a lot about it. And it's all about war. And war, war exclusion is a good, it's a nice attempt to address systemic risk. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying attempt because we're just not sure. We're just not sure if it works. I mean, now we have, I think, at least 8 different war exclusions from LMA. We have tons of war exclusions from every different marketplace. Not many have been tested, if any. So it's a nice attempt. But I wonder, you know, about the workability of it. You know, does it put someone, a company in a compromised position? Do we even get to know, you know, as far as attribution to a nation state actor, which is like the huge thing with Lloyd's right now, like how do we get to know that? That's in real time, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a huge challenge. So I do think it's a good attempt for the insurance carrier to be clear to the customer. But at the same time, until, you know, it's very abstract. So until some things actually matriculate that we know about, how are we going to do this?
Yeah, it's I think it'll I don't really know where it goes, honestly. But I think because it is so hard, it is so theoretical, it's not an easy problem to solve, because clearly you're not trying to cover a true big proper war. But the intent generally is, you know, not to stop state-sponsored attacks or other sort of common attacks. It's meant for something just sort of extreme. So then it becomes, how do you define that? And then even if you define it in a way that works theoretically, if you're on the claim side of that, somebody's calling you for a coverage decision, that's going to be such a tricky thing to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, and if you talk to some theorists, we've been, you know, since the 80s, we've been in a war with Russia, and, you know, the cyber war, you know, ransomware as a service is a manifestation of that. Like, you know, so there could be really like broad concepts of what that means.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You're just like, what are you actually saying? That could be everybody. That could be every. But again, I go back to the, well, if insurance doesn't cover anything, it's not an insurance product anymore. I think you kind of have to, rather than obsessing too much over what it says, or like exactly what the, you know, how you can interpret the word, like, that, okay, maybe that'll go through the courts. But I think the reality is, like, we kind of know what it's meant to do. It's just, it's really hard to be really specific in that.
Right.
So that's where the challenge is.
Right. And I think like maybe like if the issue is, which I suspect this is the issue, like if there was an event that happened at the same time to a lot of different companies mm-hmm. because of war, then I don't really feel comfortable paying for that. That's not a risk that I wanted to take on. That's different than, you know, just looking at the war exclusion in isolation. So to me, I like the attempts to change the policy wording on the systemic risk piece of it better. I prefer that clarity to say, well, this is what we're really worried about, a widespread incident. War could have collateral consequences here or there. You weren't an intended target. Okay. Yeah. A systemic event, I can't take that on.
Yeah. It makes sense. I guess, you know, sort of thinking about risk tolerance, you know, it is a hard one. I think risk tolerance is one that's maybe a little bit like the war exclusion, trying to figure out what it really means. I guess from your perspective, how do you really know what it is? Like, how do you really know what the systemic risk is? How do you really know what your risk tolerance is? And how do you kind of go about calculating it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think there's a real secret sauce here that I'm about to expose, but you know, a lot of carriers rely on modeling companies, you know, to do that kind of analysis to help corporations make those decisions about risk tolerance. Like, risk tolerance is going to be at very simple, in very simple terms, what is your willingness to take on certain amounts of loss compared to your equity position or your capital position? Mm-hmm. You know, what you are forecasting for shareholder profitability. So how you do that, I think, is where the art and the science come in. You know, the science part, you can rely on these cyber models that we have access to. You can build your own model, and the models are great because they help sort of build in real time the technographic and firmographic information that you would want to know. And so there's the actuarial science and the data piece of it. But yeah, it's still tough because we haven't had a true event set, I would say. You know, it depends what you think of as a systemic event. You know, there's a lot of different definitions around the globe about what that means. No one has really settled on it. You know, if you take the PCS index, I think a cyber catastrophic event is anything that amasses over $200 million in loss. But that's like an after the fact kind of look. Mm-hmm. You know, like at the time, let's say Log4j, we are aware about it as an industry. We don't know how much it's going to cost long term. So we don't know if that's, you know, a catastrophic event. It's always like a looking back
kind of position. Because that's going to be the kind of thing that just goes on and on for, you know, somebody's probably going to get hit on a Log4j vulnerability in 10 years. Yeah. You know?
Right.
So.
And then like maybe in 10 years, it'll say, oh, that was a catastrophic event. But I don't know if that's helpful now, today.
Yeah.
But you know, so there's been a lot of attempts to like to define what we're really concerned about, or what it would take a tremendous amount of capital or equity to sort of manage through. So I think that's what you're doing when you're analyzing your risk tolerance and how much you're willing to take on. And it really depends what your, you know, the rest of your portfolio looks like too. You know, if everything's running really well, maybe you take on more risk. But the bottom line is everyone really appreciates, or people are starting to appreciate, and the reinsurance market really appreciates, is that there is an extreme tail when it comes to cyber. And there's not, I would say, a global solution to that tail. So it has to be thought about and incorporated when you're looking at your risk tolerance.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. I say that a lot. It makes sense. But it's because it just means I'm listening. I promise. It's been doing the podcast has been great for my listening skills. I actually am much better at paying attention to what people are saying, because you really have to focus. I finish these and I walk away and I'm like, oh, my head hurts so much.
Yeah, yeah. I just It's not, you know, it's really hard. Yeah. It's really abstract once you start talking about this kind of, you know, what could the future look like? Mm-hmm. And we don't have a lot of data to go on.
Yeah. So,
you don't want to be like too fear driven, right? Because it's like, yeah. if you start to think about things that could happen, you know, I think what we've been really good about as an industry is, you know, the event scenarios, like these mm-hmm. are realistic event scenarios.
Yeah.
It used to be like this view of if you pull out the plug, the whole internet goes out, you know, and yeah. I think we've come down from that. Like, well, it's not that scary.
I'm, you know, when I started working in IT, I think you probably could have taken the whole internet down with just a couple of, you know, what do you mean you shut down the root DNS servers or, you know, maybe some kind of networking gear going crazy might have been a more likely one. But yeah, I think we've moved past it now, hopefully.
You know what I think, though? It's like, you know, we have advances in technology all the time. Computing technology, artificial intelligence developments, utilizing huge data sets with these AI algorithms. Quantum computing is probably a few years down the line. So,
yeah.
I don't think it's something that people can get away with not thinking about, even if they're really not in the cyber business or, alternatively, if you're a buyer and you're like, well, I have cyber insurance, I don't need to think about this anymore. It's not true. I really think you really, as a company, need to understand where you sit in the ecosystem and what your impact points are for some of these events that carriers are talking about and reinsurers are talking about and actuaries are talking about. I think we can as insurers, do a better job of explaining those to the brokers and having that communication to the risk managers at corporations, because I think if I were a risk manager, I really would want to know that. And I would want to know if what I'm buying is adequate and if not, like how much capital I need to put aside for my company in the event that happens.
Yeah, it's I guess it kind of, you know, if somebody isn't able to get, sorry, just sort of drifting off into another topic. If somebody isn't able to get enough coverage, you know, maybe we'll start seeing more and more captives and people kind of spinning up. I saw some announcement not that long ago about some companies building like a mutual, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, and doing that in Europe. But it'll be interesting to see where the industry goes in terms of other sort of innovative ways of building insurance, you know, maybe a part of a tower or whatever, just to, you know, because of the fact that there's kind of all this fear around big systemic events or, you know, it's difficult to get capacity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of easy to blame technology for all this. You know, you have all this easy doing business that comes out of it, but then at the same time, the downside is all of that technology being compromised at the same time. You know, I think you and I are probably one of the last generations that, like, you know, when I started insurance, I had paper files, you know.
Yeah. So early in my career, it was funny because we had, that was sort of the era, the early 2000s was kind of the era of the worm. You know, there was all these worms coming out like 99 from 99 to maybe 3 or 4. And everybody was on the internet. You know, firewalls were, maybe you had a firewall, but it was super primitive if you had one at all. And yeah, we just, everything would be down. Like, yep, we got hit by a virus. Everybody's down. But it wasn't ransomware. And everybody had things on paper in the phone. Whereas nowadays, you know, if that were to happen, you'd be done. Like everybody gone.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that the business interruption's gotten a lot worse. And, you know, it's been such an issue with big game ransomware like 2018, 2019. And like you said earlier, it's definitely driven a lot of the price increase and the loss ratios. What would you say are kind of maybe from your perspective, important things to keep in mind when it comes to BI?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting point. So the time, you know, property calls it time element. I don't think anyone anticipated that the time element piece would be this big. And, you know, I think that's the biggest threat, that's the existentiality of the business. So now when you're having workarounds from ransomware attackers, they're not necessarily encrypting your data, but they're using other leverage points to threaten the business. One of those is business interruption. I mean, even if you have, you know, air-gapped, you know, data and you can recover from a ransomware event, you still don't want to lose the time you know, being down. So like that is, it's just so clever on the part of the criminal to leverage that piece of it. I'm not sure what else I can say about that, but that continues to be the hugest driver of loss, I think, for the industry, whether it's coming from ransomware or another event, you know, a cloud outage scenario. That's the biggest driver. And I've seen some interesting kind of perspectives on that recently in the coverage or in the product. I've heard of at least one carrier saying, well, if we pay the ransomware amount, that's actually mitigating your business interruption. So, you know, you're not going to get like your full kit and caboodle of your claimed time down. So that's interesting. And, you know, I think we'll probably start to see a little bit more, you know, attention on the forensic accounting piece of business interruption and, you know, how those statements of loss or proofs of loss are put together and what people are claiming. So I think that will, that'll be interesting to see in the next couple of years.
I think it's, from a cyber resilience perspective, you know, we could gain a lot of insight as well from these ransomware events happening, the forensic accountants getting involved, and then they can circle back on a proactive kind of way and say, here's the things you need to be ready for. Here's some ways you can have workarounds, you know, because business should still, it's just we've become dependent, but you should be able to still operate in a reduced, you know, operational capacity, even if, you know, lots of your IT is down. It's just we've become so dependent and so streamlined and everything's tech. It's like 100% or 0%. And the reality is maybe there's a way we can be more resilient and operate at a percentage.
That's a really good point. And like, that's something, unfortunately, I think that's one of the hardest pieces of the underwriting to know. Mm. Because people say they have incident response plans. People say they have, you know, they have recovery plans, but, you know, and they practice them. But you don't know what that means. You don't know the quality of that unless you're doing like these tabletop exercises with the insureds or if they have an incident, right? Like, you don't know. And then like they have an incident and, you know, it could go really poorly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it is very hard. It's a hard thing to know, not just for the underwriter, like you're saying, it's not necessarily a situation where the person buying the insurance is saying, well, yes, we have all these things, they're great. It's that they don't actually know either. So it's not just the underwriter. It's not just hard for the underwriter. It's hard for the people running a company to know it. But I think that's probably one area where we're probably getting better at, because the outages have been happening. So it's forcing, say, experts in the field to gain this knowledge. We just kind of need to connect everybody and make sure they're taking into account, you know, what the forensic accountants maybe are seeing and where the real losses are. And hopefully that helps with cyber resilience. So it's interesting. So I guess, you know, we've talked a lot about systemic risk. It's definitely, I can tell it's something that's on your mind. What would you say some of the solutions we haven't discussed yet around systemic risk?
Well, I think you know, it's twofold. It's really a customer. There should be a customer facing solution. Mm-hmm. And then there should be a back end solution, internal. How do I manage the tail through reinsurance or other kinds of solutions? Like, those two things really both need to happen. You can't really be hyper focused on one over the other. For the front facing solution, customers need to know what we're covering, need to be really clear. Like, if you wouldn't buy property insurance without knowing if the flood is going to be covered or not. So we need to make sure that we're clear on that to the customer and the broker. Okay. And it's great. It's developing. A lot of people are developing that kind of product. But the back end, you know, how we manage it internally, you know, it's not like catastrophic risk with cyber going away. Even if we address it front facing, we still have to figure out what to do on the back end. So we have a highly constrained reinsurance market without a lot of capacity. There's 75% of all cyber insurance risk with approximately three reinsurers, and their cap, you know, loss caps are very common. So, you know, there's still that extreme tail risk. So, you know, capital solutions, you know, capital markets are interested in the space, but it's not fully developed. Mm-hmm. So I think the insurance industry needs to do a lot more, explaining the risk, or coming to an understanding with reinsurers or capital markets about the risk, and getting better at predictive modeling. And, I think that those two things coming into focus will be the solution. You know, there was an article on Slate the other day about how cyber insurance was invented, like on a beach in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And there's all these articles that come up all the time about like people claiming to have invented this.
Yeah.
And it's possible it was invented by multiple people in different places, but we need to read.
It's like calculus. Like calculus. Everybody's claiming it.
But I think we're at a point where, you know, we need another like big reinvention of it. I think we're at that point.
Sorry, I had to make the engineering joke there. There's no way I could resist that.
Too good.
So, cool. I guess, you know, just talking about current events, you know, what do you think something that's really interesting in cyber right now?
I know it probably sounds not all that cutting edge, but what's endlessly fascinating to me is the Russian-Ukraine war and the companion cyber warfare. And I think especially when this first, you know, came out, you know, Microsoft was putting out updates and Microsoft was working hand in hand with Ukraine. And we saw all this intelligence coming in through a combination of the public and private sector. You know, it's just so interesting to me that this army of ants mobilize around political perspectives or sociopolitical perspectives. And, you know, we operate under this assumption, especially in ransomware as a service type of model, that these criminals are always operating under, you know, the impetus of money, financial gain. And that sort of shifted with the Russian-Ukraine war, and it may be similar with, you know, Chinese-Taiwan conflict, if that manifests into something, God forbid. But I think, you know, it's a new, I'm not like I don't have a master's in warfare or anything like that, but I do think this is just endlessly fascinating. And it's always the folks that are not doing cyber that are very interested in this and how this sort of warfare is developing.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot from a cyber and probably a non-cyber perspective. I think the Ukraine-Russia war is something that a lot of people are going to study for a long time. It's been a different kind of war, certainly. And it's multifaceted. Sort of the cyber attacks that we saw, kind of, as you said, maybe some of the groups drifting away a bit from their financial motivations. You know, sort of the social media, you know, and success on social media and sort of propaganda through social media has been interesting, and how, you know, intelligence through social media, information being shared, you know, and that's all outside of sort of the traditional kinetic warfare, which I think has been really pretty interesting as well. You know, I was a very long time ago in the Marines, and I paid a lot of attention to some of the things they're doing there as well. It's kind of, you know, you watch a video of somebody dropping a grenade into a tank and things like that from a drone. You're like, yeah, the world's definitely changed.
Oh my gosh.
it's really something to watch. Okay, well, cool. We've got a few closing questions I always like to ask, just to get to know people and their advice a little better. So how did you originally get into the insurance industry?
Great question. So I was in law school and I was doing a lot of work, public service work, public defenders, and for juveniles. I was helping women who are being stalked and abused, and I really wanted to work with the public, and I eventually got into criminal law.
Okay.
I did an internship with the DOJ, did an internship with the public federal defenders, and, really liked criminal law. And I did a clerkship with a criminal law judge, but then the market fell out. There were really no jobs in government. And so I went to a law firm. I started doing insurance coverage, litigation, which I thought would be very temporary.
Yeah.
Turns out not so much.
15 years later.
So then I went in-house and I started doing D&O claims, EPL claims. And there was that nexus a little bit with that white collar crime aspect that I like. But I really, I gravitated towards cyber eventually. My husband was doing cyber. It's like his life. So, his work life is so much more interesting than mine. And that I really.
Okay. So he was first then.
He was first. Yeah. He taught me a lot. But I was like, this is great. And I really like the fact that it's an emerging risk. And I know it's still it's old now, 30 years old. It's still an emerging risk. So it's I like the concept of reinventing, and you really can do a lot with it as far as creativity. And then it has that nexus to the criminal sphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'll probably be emerging in 30 more years.
I agree.
It's like the never ending emerging risk. So you're always can just sort of, redo it every time. Every time. So I guess the next question then is, what would you recommend to anyone who wants to have a successful career in the insurance industry?
I would say try lots of different things. I did a lot of different disciplines. A lot of people think, I'm doing claims, so I'm going to be in claims forever. That's great. If you like it, do that forever. But I tried a lot of different areas and you can do that in insurance. You can get exposure to legal, product, business development, claims, underwriting, all different aspects, all different lines, expose yourself to that. Some programs in insurance companies are specifically set up for that. They'll put you in a track program and they'll, expose you to all different things. But if you don't have that, you don't have access to that, create it for yourself. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. The second thing is learn reinsurance.
Yeah.
Learn it. Everyone, it's kind of one of those magical skills
that
very few people know, but then once you know it, it's very helpful for your perspective, no matter where you are in the company.
Shane, trying to get a reinsurance guest. So maybe that can be my learning of reinsurance. It is something I didn't feel. It wasn't so clear to me. And then I've a couple comments I've seen people make in regards to reinsurance on cyber. And I started to think, wait a minute, that's a lot more interesting than I'd ever considered before. Wait a minute. I better figure out this reinsurance deal. What's that all about? How's that work? So cool. Well, thanks for that advice.
Sure.
Last question. Who should be our next podcast guest and why?
Well, you know who you should talk to? You should bring Tom Johannesmeyer. Do you know him?
I don't think so.
Oh man, he's a fascinating guy. He knows all about reinsurance.
Okay.
He's doing his master's in warfare, but he works for PCS Verisk. So he's a cyber expert, understands all about that cat space, but has a really interesting perspective on the nexus of cyber and war. Very smart guy. I think you have.
Definitely. Well,
I'll make it
on that. Yeah, that'd be amazing. Appreciate it. Well, cool. Well, it was a lot of fun chatting with you, and really enjoyed having you on the show. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Anthony. This is great. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks.
All right. See you soon.
See you soon.
If you want to learn more about our host, Anthony, or his company, Aceris, visit Aceris.com. Aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.